bring in that picture of how the extent of Roman citizenship gave citizens rights, and I'll go through that in a moment, all over that very large empire. Koine Greek, or common Greek, was widely used, and many, many people, most would know some Greek enough to be able to converse, and many, you know, were very fluent, as Paul was, and others in Jesus' day. Roman rule was brutal in the conduct and the enforcement of peace, law, and order. They were very regimented. They had extensive civil codes of the laws. I'll mention that in just a moment. And the Romans, at least up to Jesus' time, were generally tolerant of local religions, but brutally suppressed riots and rebellions. And you can see this in the case of Paul. Remember when he went into the temple and was accused of taking a Gentile in there, and there was a riot. He was almost killed on the spot. The local commander, who was a Roman soldier, was very much afraid of that getting out of hand and creating a riot, which would probably have cost him his job, if not his life. So we can see that so many things came together in the fullness of time to set the stage, if you will, for Jesus coming into the world. Just to have quick pictures here, just see these are modern pictures of the old Roman roads. Notice the size of these paving stones there, and of course they've lasted 2,000 years plus, but it shows the extent of the road system. This is one of the coolest pictures I found. This is the Roman road system shown as a modern-day transit map. So it's a little light, but you can see this is Italy here that I'm encircling with the laser. This is Spain over here. Of course, modern-day France, which was known as Gaul to the Romans. This would have been Greece here, and then modern-day Turkey, and now on down into Palestine, Judea, and so on. And then Egypt, all the way across the continent of Africa, the northern part of Africa. But notice how these roads were laid out. They were definitely not haphazard. And imagine the traveler of the day, 2,000 years ago, could pretty much connect with the entire road system. I guess you had to learn, you know, the colors, just like you do today. No, I'm just kidding. This is laid out as a modern transit map, but the roads were actually laid out as they're shown here. Pretty cool.
So Al?
Yeah.
I see that you could go across the Strait of Gibraltar.
No, that's not on a land bridge, but that would be in white there, so I think that would not be a road across the Strait. They would sail across that, but it's not that far, and people did that. In fact, you know, take a ferry across that even in those days. This is just a picture. This is a massive building. It's in a basilica. I used to think of basilica as a specific thing, but what it was really, it was a pattern. It was an architectural pattern, to include the arches in there, which basically form large auditoriums, and it was used for many buildings, you know, for the city officials and for many other things. Two quick pictures of aqueducts built in 312 BC. Well, the first one was built in 312, so 300 years prior to Christ. The Romans were building aqueducts to bring water in, sometimes from miles and miles away. For example, in a mountainous area, they would bring the water down into a city-funded area. The architecture, of course, had to be developed using the arch, which was their one of their primary engineering tools. And these aqueducts here are still, some of them are actually being used today in some of the rural areas. Roman law, and again, if you like, I know I'm going through it pretty quickly. You'll have these slides. You want to go back over them. Let me know by email or however if you have questions about things. I'm going to them in a little more detail. Roman law, very systematic, dependent on precedent, much like, of course, ours is today, because we, in some ways, are descendants of Roman law, and particularly in the formation of the law. It included the very specific written rights of a Roman citizen. Paraphrasing, it would be Roman citizens can do this, this, and this. They cannot do this, this, and this, and laid out the rights. A defendant and a plaintiff. So if you went to court with somebody, somebody's ox got out and gored your ox or broke down your fence, the defendant and the plaintiff had to represent themselves at a hearing, as there was no system of legal representation. So when we read in the Bible of a lawyer like Tertullus, he's more of an orator. You can almost even call him kind of a public relations guy. He's not arguing the law. He's more or less giving a summary of the other side's claims, for example, but not arguing point by point. Penalties for crimes were designed as deterrent. In other words, we're going to give you this penalty so to prevent you from doing that action, that crime again, rather than as corrective measures. The deterrents themselves, penalties could include fines, prison, castigation, confiscation of property, loss of citizenship, exile, forced labor, or the death penalty, obviously. Males of higher social status usually received more lenient penalties. That's still true in some areas today, but it certainly was back then. The severity of the penalty, this was interesting to me, could depend on such factors as premeditation. Did you sit down? Did you plan this thing? Did you, you know, plan the attack on someone or the theft? Were you provoked in it? Did someone hit you? Did somebody say something or otherwise provoke you into the crime? The frequency of it, is it's the first time you've ever done it? Are you a young person and perhaps, you know, could be forgiven of it for one or two times? And even the influence of alcohol. So you see, so much of that is still in common cultures, in modern cultures today. Rights of a Roman citizen, this again, fascinating. They could vote. So in local elections or for the Senate in Rome when it was in the area or still a republic, Roman citizen could hold office. They retained their citizenship regardless of location. So if you were a Roman citizen in Italy and you went into Judea or Jerusalem, you remained as a Roman citizen, just like Paul did in both Philippi and, of course, in Rome when he was arrested there. Citizens can own property. Unlike slaves, they could not own property. Lawful marriage. The children of a citizen became a citizen. So Paul, I believe he even says that he was born a citizen. So undoubtedly his father either had been born a citizen or had become a citizen in some manner. Just a quick note on that. In many cases, Roman officers or soldiers were given citizenship if they did not have it before. And in some cases, entire cities, such as Philippi, would be deemed a Roman city. And from that point, people in that city were citizens, and children born in that city would automatically become citizens. There were also rights for some citizens that they didn't have to pay some taxes, especially local taxes. And this was all tracked very meticulously. A census was established to track the taxation. Who is who? What taxes should they be paying? And so in Luke 2, with the birth of Jesus, Caesar Augustus, which we now know as Octavian, he declared a census that all the world, meaning the Roman world, you saw the image of it, is going to be taxed. And so you were to go to the city of your birth. Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus, was of the tribe of David. Bethlehem was the city of David. So Joseph, Mary, go down to Bethlehem to be taxed. And of course, Jesus is born while they're there. Roman citizens are allowed to sue in court.
and to be sued. They can defend oneself in court, such as Paul did before Felix. Again, very interesting. As a Roman citizen, he can give his defense, and he did it before Felix, before Festus, and eventually appealed all the way to Nero. And I believe it was Festus that said, you know, Paul would have been released had he not appealed to Nero. You are entitled to a legal trial with a judge and to appeal an adverse decision all the way up to the supreme decision, which would have been with the emperor. This was important. A Roman citizen could not be tortured, could not be whipped, could not receive a death penalty unless found guilty of treason. And again, Paul in Acts 22 and 24, when he was arrested, you remember that he had been whipped or was about to be whipped. And he says to the centurion or to the soldier, says, is it legal to whip to beat a Roman citizen? And I'm telling you, that probably that Roman in charge, that Roman officer probably did not sleep that night, because he would have been in big trouble had he beaten Paul. Roman rule in Israel in 63 BC. Again, you had absolute ruler at that time, the Caesar, the ruler. Antipater, or you might call him Antipater, I think it's pronounced Antipater. He was an Idumean, and I'll just to review that. Idumeans were descendants of Esau. You remember that Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the son of promise. Esau eventually became a father of a great nation also. And they were initially called Edomites. Edom, I believe, was the Hebrew word for red. That word had morphed into Idumean by the first century BC. Antipater, the Idumeans had been forced into converting to Judaism by a man named John Hyrcanus. Who was John Hyrcanus? He was the grandson of Mattathias, who had started the Maccabean Revolution, which we talked about at length last Wednesday. Have a little more to say about that in a moment. So Antipater had cozied up with the Romans, and he was made the procurator, which really is a glorified tax collector, by Caesar in 47 BC. His son, that is Antipater's son, Herod, was appointed king by the Roman Senate, with the support of both Mark Antony and Octavian. Herod was appointed king in 40 BC, but he had to fight for it. He actually used soldiers from Rome to help him, you know, fight his enemies and then take the throne in 37 BC. And he was the, quote, king of the Jews at Jesus' birth. Josephus tells us about the brutal nature of Herod. And this is a quote from Josephus's writings that said Herod savored no humanity. This is a man that had killed at least one of his wife, two of his sons, many supposed enemies. And Josephus says that when Herod was on his deathbed, he was afraid that no one in Judea would mourn his death. And Josephus says that Herod commanded that prominent Jews be brought to Jerusalem and be killed on the same day that Herod died, so there would be mourning and moaning in Jerusalem. Just another quick point on that. Skeptics say that there's no outside record of Herod commanding the death of the babies, of the babies in Bethlehem under the age of two. But he certainly is seen in many outside writings, such as Josephus and others, as a brutal, brutal man, very, very evil. So to organize this a little bit, the kings are called in Judea now, they're called the rulers, highest rulers in the territories. They're also called tetrarch. Tetrarch meaning one of four kings, and that'll become evident to you in a moment when I show you the Roman map of Judea and the other areas. So for example, Herod Antipas was the king at the death of Jesus. He's also the man, the king, that had John the Baptist murdered. You remember up on the dancing of the of Herodias's daughter in front of Herod Antipas. Herod Agrippa II was, quote, a king, again, a tetrarch, not of the whole area, but roughly a fourth of the territory. You also had governors. These were Roman governors. Three prominent ones were Pilate, Felix, and Festus. So they would be a ruler in a various region under a king such as Antipas or Agrippa II. They made routine tax and judicial decisions on behalf of Rome, particularly made sure that the taxes were flowing. And of course, they got a cut of the taxes as they went up the chain, made their way to Rome. Religion among the Gentiles was largely filled with grotesque idolatry, myths, mysticism, human philosophies, very much described in Acts 14. But there were some Jewish proselytes and God-fearers. An example, of course, would be Cornelius in Acts 10. I put this in there not to memorize, but you may want to go back later and just look at this. This is a chart of the Hasmoneans with the Herods included. Antipas, again, was an Idumean. He was the father of Herod the Great, who was also an Idumean, and Phasael. Phasael was a brother of Herod the Great. They ended up fighting each other for control of the whole area. Herod actually had to flee, went into Egypt, ironically, made his way to Rome, and was eventually appointed by the Roman Senate and given control of the whole area. He later, obviously, was given the title of Herod the Great. Much of his, quote, greatness was because of his architectural accomplishment. He was a tremendous builder. You can see the descendants of Herod the Great, Herod Philip, Herod, another Herod Philip, Herod Antipas, who was called that fox by Jesus. Archelaus was given one of the regions, and so on. This is a this is really a massive thing. It almost looks like a volcano. What it really is, it's a fortress about 15 to 20 miles south of Jerusalem. This is where Herod built. His intent was to flee there, get away from his enemies, and be able to hold up, you know, for a year or more, because it would be very difficult to overcome that if it were, you know, surrounded by at least loyal soldiers. Some things never change. This is a massive thing. It's been obviously excavated in modern times. This is another fortress called Masada. Some of you will have read about that. This was the last ditch of many hundreds of Jews against the Romans later on in the revolt that ended in the destruction of Jerusalem. Jews got up into this, Jewish fighters got into this and, you know, swore to fight to the last man and then committed ritual suicide in a sense when they saw they were going to be overtaken. This is Caesarea Harbor. Now, this is a painting, really, based on a description by Josephus. Herod curried the favor of Rome and particularly the emperor, Caesar Augustus. So he builds this huge harbor in Caesarea, and of course it names Caesarea after Caesar Augustus. It was said to be a beautiful thing. Of course, much of it has also been excavated. These are two ruins of ancient Caesarea Maritima. Now, there was a Caesarea Philippi up, I believe, just east of the city of Galilee. This is Caesarea Maritima on the shore. Beautiful spot and was a big vacation spot even back then. Key thing for our purposes, this was the headquarters of the Roman army in Palestine. So this is where the larger troop formations would have been kept and undoubtedly rotated out to Jerusalem and to other areas on a somewhat regular basis. This is where Paul was being taken when he was ferreted out in the middle of the night, not in the middle of the night, but late at night, out of Jerusalem. They went about halfway that night and went on in to Caesarea. So this is where Paul would have been held, not this city would be. And then that's where he would have appeared before Felix and Festus and finally appealed to Caesar. Synagogues, they're mentioned 57 times in the New Testament. They certainly were prominent in the late first century. They were places for prayers, reading, studies of the law. And it's probable, not absolutely sure, that they originated during the Babylonian captivity, when the Jews in Babylon obviously did not have the temple to offer the sacrifices and so on. The temple actually had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Jesus spoke in many of them, as did Paul, and I think it's safe to assume he gave his approval for the synagogues during his day. The temple in Jerusalem was built. It had been rebuilt, of course, under Zerubbabel after the return into Israel and after the Babylonian captivity. Animal sacrifice, that was the second temple. Herod had started a big, huge improvement program that went on till 64 AD. It was never not completed until then, which turns out, ironically, to be only about 6 years before its total destruction in 70 AD by the Roman army. There were three primary feasts, unleavened bread and Passover, kind of taken together, Pentecost, the tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. And then by Jesus' time, there were three other celebrations. There were Purim, which celebrated the salvation of the Jewish people in Esther's times. There was Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. And then there was Hanukkah, which was that Feast of Lights or dedication during the Maccabean period in 164 BC. The Sanhedrin was the supreme Jewish ruling body in Jerusalem. It was composed of 71 Jewish elders. They had a meeting hall in just off the temple area, with one entrance to the outside and one entrance to the temple. They met regularly with 71 elders. They were presided over by the high priest of that time. It's also interesting that there were lesser Sanhedrins. Sanhedrin just meaning an assembly. These lesser Sanhedrins would be in bigger towns outside of Jerusalem, usually had 23 members, and again, they decided civil and religious cases. In the New Testament, in the Gospels and in the Acts and in other places where you see the council, that's generally referring to the Sanhedrin. It is one that condemned Christ, persecuted the apostles, gave a letter of authority to go up to Damascus to persecute Christians there. Quick example of this is an actual photograph of a replica of a synagogue in Nazareth, just to give you kind of a feel for what they look like. These are the ruins. This was pretty elaborate one. This is on the Golan Heights of modern Israel today. Been excavated, of course, but you can see the columns, fairly large area in there, which I guess you'd call it the auditorium part. Pharisees, 100 times mentioned in the New Testament. They were prominent as early as the 3rd century, which would have been, you know, the 200s. They protested the Hellenization. What was that? Hellenization was the spreading of the Greek culture that began around Alexander the Great and extended by his descendants. Pharisee itself, the word means separated ones. And the idea, I think, is they're separated from the profane Jews, from the ungodly Jews, and particularly the ones that had given themselves over to Greek culture. They were the religious conservatives during Jesus' time. They accepted Jewish traditions. You recall from the Gospels, the conflicts over washing of hands and eating on the Sabbath in the field of grain, many of the Sabbath rules, that how far you could travel and so on. They considered Roman rule as punishment to the Jews for sin, but it was to be accepted as God's will until it was lifted. In other words, generally speaking, the Pharisees weren't out there sabotaging the Romans or attacking them at night and that kind of thing. The Pharisees often became self-righteous and hypocritical people who cared about their external appearances, elevated these traditions even above the Word of God. Mark 7 and many other places show that. the Sadducees accepted Greek culture. They were all in for the Greeks and had a much greater concern for the politics. The origin of them is still debated. Some feel that it came from the word Zadok, who was the high priest during David's reign. But just as a warning, when you read on this, you'll see different opinions as to when and where they came from. They generally had kind of a low view of God. They denied the resurrection. They denied angels, even though angels are mentioned, of course, in the Old Testament too. John Hyrcanus, who was the grandson of Mattathias, so he was in the Hasmonean hierarchy. He was a Pharisee, but he thought that the Pharisees had opposed him. In fact, they gave some really dirty rumors about him. Just quickly, a fellow Pharisee spread a rumor that John Hyrcanus was actually the illegitimate son, guess what, of Antiochus Epiphanes, which was a total lie. But John Hyrcanus switched from the Pharisee party to the Sadducee and made the high priest a Sadducee, and it remained that way afterwards. So that in Jesus' time, the high priest was still of the Sadducee party or sect. The Sadducees had much greater influence in the temple. They pretty much ran it. They were the religious liberals in the days of Jesus, and again, very sophisticated in their view, too sophisticated to believe in spirits, angels, resurrection. I have a little time to read it. I'm going to just read this. This is out of Davis Dictionary of the Bible. Again, you've got it here. You can go back and read it. I'll read it pretty quickly. The Pharisees were one of the three chief Jewish sects. It was the strictest sect. In all probability, the Pharisees originated in the period before the Maccabean War in a reaction against the Hellenizing spirit, which appeared among the Jews and manifested itself in the readiness of a part of the people to adopt Grecian cultures. Down in the red at the bottom, at first, when one incurred great danger in joining the party, in other words, you could lose your head by joining the party, the Pharisees were men of strong religious character. They were the best people in the nation. Very true in many movements that, you know, the hardcore, the ones that rebel or the ones that fight or the ones that believe the hardest, it's very hard to pass that passion down to the second and third generations. Sorry about that. Sadducees, again from Davis Dictionary, it appears that the members and adherents of the highest priestly aristocracy constituted the party. It is now generally believed that the name refers to the high priest Zadok, who officiated in David's reign and in whose family the high priesthood remained until the political confusion of the Maccabean times, his descendants and partisans being Zadokites or Sadducees. Okay, I'll move on. There's a comparison of the two that'll be in your slides if you want to go back. It's really pretty much what we just went over. Notice at the bottom of the slide, most Jews were in neither of these groups. It'd be a mistake to believe that the common Jews, were members or much less strong members of either the Pharisees or the Sadducees. Two other sects were zealots. They sought to overthrow Roman rule. Some refused to pay taxes and considered loyalty to Caesar a sin. Very much opposed to the Roman overthrow. They were on the extreme left of the Pharisees, and they eventually lead a revolt against the Romans in 66 AD, which ends up with the Romans completely destroying Jerusalem, killing massive numbers of Jews, and essentially destroying Judaism as a functioning organized religion. Herodians were loyal to Herod and Roman rule. They were the liberal element of the Sadducees. It's like, Herod's great, whatever he does, we'll support. The Essenes, very small, deeply religious group. The key thing there, they really aren't mentioned at all in the New Testament, but we know they existed. They went out into caves near the Dead Sea. Prodigious copiers and collectors of the Old Testament scrolls. And those were, of course, discovered in the year of my birth, 1947, and they're known today as the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that was a very good year. The scribes are the guardians and teachers of Scripture. key thing there, the scribes sometimes in the Bible, New Testament, are used to denote Sadducees and the so-called lawyers or the doctors of the law. Okay, quick geography exercise. I'll be done, I think, in 5 minutes. Under the Romans, they divided this whole area up into four main parts: Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and Perea. Decapolis was a totally Greek area and was composed of 10 cities that had been more or less dedicated back in Greek times. Samaria was a blend of Jews and others that had been brought in after the fall of the Northern Kingdom in 722 by the Assyrians. So there was a remnant of remaining Jews that intermarried with pagans and produced a really strange blend of religion. Here's the key to understand. Samaria, the city, and the temple that they had built in Mount Gerizim was leveled by John Hyrcanus in 128 BC. In fact, it is said that his goal was to remove any semblance, any sign of a civilization there. And of course, by Jesus' time, there was extremely bad blood between the most of the Jews and the Samaritan people. Jews would even go around the eastern side of the Jordan River to avoid going through Samaria. This is a map, interesting map. This is the Roman division of Israel in the time of Jesus. So you had the Galilee in the north, Samaria, Judah, of course, containing Jerusalem, and then Perea on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and kind of surrounded by a large area known as Decapolis. Almost done. Daniel 2, verse 20, 22. So Daniel praised the God of heaven, saying, "Let the name of God be praised forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. He changes times and seasons, deposing some kings and establishing others. He gives wisdom to the wise, imparts knowledge to those with understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness, and the light resides with him." There is the, go back to that very quickly. We kind of began this study with Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He was living in the time of the Babylonian Empire. He prophesied the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, and the Roman Empire. And it was during that fourth kingdom, the Romans, that a kingdom would be built without hands, and it would subdue all of the others. And of course, I believe, and I think you do, that that is the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Christ. For further study, I think it's really helpful to really get into Daniel's prophecies. We've gone into it somewhat. You could go very much deeper, particularly Daniel 2, 8, and 11. A study of Greek culture, the rise of the synagogues, Pharisees, Sadducees, Sanhedrin, the Maccabean revolt, and the Hasmoneans, and the history of Herod the Great and his successors, along with Roman government and rule, rights of Roman citizens. The whole goal of this short series is to maybe give us a bit of a better context as the New Testament just kind of comes on the scene after roughly 400 years of no, at least, inspired scripture after the book of Malachi. All right, that's all I've got. Any quick questions before we go?
Thanks, Al.
All right, are we good?
Al?
All right. Anything else?
Al?
Yes.
When you showed the pictures of those two mountains?
Yes.
There were two pictures. Are they the same place or two different things? Or they didn't make sense. I couldn't see the relationship between the two photos.
Oh, those were roads, Lori. I was just pointing out the roads.
Oh,
the Roman roads.
Place that I think Herod built to escape to?
Oh, no, they were the same place. They were just different photos of the same place. It was, that is actually a man-made hill, in essence. They built that up from rocks and dirt and put a palace up on the top of that. So what you were really looking at, down at is the remains, the ruins of that palace up on top of that man-made hill.
They were like two different angles?
Yes, two different angles. Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
That was a casualty of perhaps going too fast, but I really wanted to get through this tonight. So, anything else?